Sun Ra playing Jerome Kern's Yesterdays. And another reminder that Bob Muggy's film on Sun Ra, which is called Make a Joyful Noise, will be playing tomorrow night in Germantown at the Calvary Episcopal Church in Germantown. The number, if you want to find out more information, is 843-2550. It's about 8 minutes after 4 o'clock, and you're listening to WUHY in Philadelphia. My guest is actress Susan Strasberg, who comes from very special theater origins. Her father, Lee Strasberg, was the director of the Actors Studio, where he instructed many young actors, people like Paul Newman, Marlon Brando, Marilyn Monroe, and Jimmy Dean, in the approach which came to be known as method acting. Susan Strasberg's mother was also an actress and became very close with Marilyn Monroe. Susan Strasberg started gaining her professional identity at a young age, at 17, when she appeared on Broadway as Anne Frank in The Diary of Anne Frank. She went on to do several films and some television work, and of course is still acting today. She's just published her memoirs, which she's titled Bittersweet. She discusses her family and what it was like to grow up with such a remarkable set of young actors who would drop into her home. Her book also deals with her love affairs with Richard Burton, Warren Beatty, and others, and with her marriage, which ended in divorce, and her daughter, Jenny, who was born with a congenital heart condition, who, after a series of successful operations, is thankfully a healthy 14-year-old.
15 now.
Okay,
going
15.
Going on 200.
Susan Strasberg is now dividing her time between acting and writing, and her memoirs, which are called Bittersweet, is published in paperback by the New American Library. Well, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
And
you mean there's fresh air left in America?
That's right.
Thank God.
Even in a not too sunny Philadelphia.
I do
right
not
now.
Think about it sometimes traveling around the country, because particularly, I guess, in the world that I live in, you have a tendency to measure reality in life in terms of exclusively New York or California. And, you know, that isn't really the pulse of the country. It is traveling around and getting out and seeing real people again. And it's as I travel through the country, I think, my God, we're living in paradise. This is the Garden of Eden. And look, between what we put into our own bodies and how we abuse ourselves emotionally and what we're doing to the air and the atmosphere, we're just wrecking it.
Well,
it's terrific. We're the problems.
You've certainly been doing a lot of traveling.
I
must admire anybody's stamina on a book tour.
Yeah.
Well, to write your book and their memoirs, which go back awfully far to actually before you were born, but you know the meat of it, I guess, starts with your early childhood.
It's only the first half of my memoirs. I'm not that old. I don't think I'd ever do this again anyway, though. Novels from now on.
Well, in writing memoirs, how does one remember their life? What's the sequence of memories that come to you?
First of all, talking about memoirs, someone asked, I saw recently on some talk show, someone asked Claire Booth Luce, was she going to write her memoirs? And was she going to write her autobiography? And she said, you mean an alibiography? Never. Which I thought, she's right, too. One doesn't want to do that. I read some of the books, and I think, oh, my God. You know, truth is so relative. And the funny thing is that I interviewed people. I tried to find, material things that people had written, letters. And people did share information with me, many of my friends. Unfortunately, because my mother had died and my father's memory is not all that, he just wasn't aware of certain things going on. I guess he was sort of immersed in his work or his studying or whatever it was, so that I'm sure there are many aspects of the truth that you can't catch. You know, it's funny. Life is like Rashomon. You get four people. I can remember, who said to me recently, do you remember? Oh, I know, a friend of mine in Paris said, remember that wonderful time we had in some resort in Italy when that prince was running after you? I said, I don't remember that. She said, oh yes, don't you remember? We laughed, we danced all night. I said, I don't remember that. I just remember when I went back, I had a terrible time. And it is so interesting. To me, what's interesting in writing the book is not what I remembered, but what I forgot.
Well, you know, when I think back on my past, or I think for a lot of people, perhaps what you remember first is either the most traumatic or...
Yes, or what you feel guilty about.
Yeah.
The things that are unresolved.
What did you learn about yourself in thinking back and trying to reconstruct? I mean, you weren't taking notes when you were growing up, so there was a lot of reaching.
What back. I learned is a lot better now than it was then. That time has been... time and life, the fates have been kind to me, I guess. You know, it's... I think I have a Henry Miller quote in the book, which I love. He said, a destiny is what you're supposed to do with your life, and fate is what comes along and kicks you in the behind to make you do it. So I had a lot of kicks, but I needed a lot. I guess I learned the hard way. I think the thing that amazes me the most is that when I see where I've arrived and I know that where I am is a transition, I think life is a continual process of change. I used to think it was like a film. You'd get to the end, to someplace where you were wonderful, and you'd say, freeze, that's it, and it would say the end, and you would just stay that way, wonderful, forever. I look back, I mean, I remember when I finished writing the book, and I thought, I've really got my life together, this is it, I'm wonderful. And then 2 years later, it sort of fell apart, and I said, I'm so dissatisfied, what's the matter, I want to go further. And now I look back on myself 2 years ago and say, God, I was foolish. Did I really think I had arrived at any place that was so marvelous? And I'm sure that now, relatively, I feel much better than I felt, let's say, last year, this time. And I'm really curious. I can't wait to see where I'm going to be, let's say, in a year. I'm not anticipating it, but just the process of change, the spontaneous things that happen to you in life are absolutely amazing. I think it's Helen Keller said something, and if Helen Keller could say it, we certainly have to say it. She said, life is either a daring adventure or nothing. Good, bad, or indifferent, it has been an adventure, and it continues to be. And you only hope that during the adventure, you don't hurt anyone else physically or emotionally.
We know, in talking about anticipating your future, when you were young, growing up, what did you think your future would be? I mean, you had, like, really a set of amazing people dropping in. What type of image of adulthood and becoming a professional did that give you?
Apart from seeing Tallulah Bankhead, who was very dramatic, and I once said to my mother, Mother, why do you have all those strange women friends? They were really, like, larger than life size. I saw Tallulah coming down a staircase once in a play and said, oh, I want to be like that when I grow up. And now I don't know whether I meant like that as an actress or like that as a woman. I shudder to think, because she was not a happy lady, you know. Couldn't take a bus either. I mean, really strange for someone as independent. She was totally dependent. I guess that's the thing that always, the thing that I fought in my life. I think women have that more than men. I didn't really, strangely enough, at the point when I began acting, which was when I was 13, it was kind of totally accidental, or one of those kicks of fate that Henry Miller talks about. I thought, well, I would like to act. However, I think I'll go to college first. I remember that I was going to High School of Music and Art, studying art. And I thought, well, if I'm going to be an actress, boy, I've seen a lot of starving actors and I've seen a lot of careers not work. I'd better have a second profession, something to fall back on. Then I kind of envisioned myself maybe taking some kind of liberal arts course. I was interested in writing, and that was my only good subject. I mean, I didn't do very well in anything else, but English I loved. I was a big reader. I was always immersed in some book that dealt with either Elizabethan history or the 18th, 19th century, the Romantics. You know, I was very romantic and impressionable and overly idealistic, I think. It was, Keats, you know, what the purpose of life is, to know that we are alive even in pain. Well, those Romantics forgot to tell you can know you're alive even in pleasure, you know, so that your expectations, and I thought, Pain and Passion, Anna Karenina was the part I would have liked to play. I mean, I now hopefully have a part with a happier ending. So that I really saw very different. I thought I'd go to college. I would maybe start to do some acting. I would do some painting that I would write. And I really, you know, they say what you see is what you get. You know, that unconsciously we be careful what you wish for, you get it. I don't remember it. It happened before I had a chance to dream it, to imagine it even. It took me totally by surprise. I just turned my life upside down, and there I was with, well, you know, in America, the degrees of success Anne Morrow Lindbergh once said something about her husband I found rather moving. She said, well, we put people up on a pedestal. They don't ask to be there, and then we wait to knock them off. I remember when I was 17 in the New York Times, I think for Picnic, Bosley Crowther or someone like that said, well, this is a performance of genius. I thought, genius? I'm 16 years old. My father is a genius. I'm not. And then about 2 years later, someone said, oh, well, Miss Strasberg should never have become an actor. I said, never become an actress? 2 years ago, I was a genius. And I thought, well, somewhere in between lies the truth. But because I was an adolescent, I didn't know yet who I was, what kind of life I wanted. I got very confused. Now, there, by the way, are young people who handle it better than I do, I'm sure. It seems to me some of the, I don't know how a girl like Brooke Hayward or Jodie Foster handle it. First of all, in the movies, it's a little different. That direct, I guess it probably was, the nature of my career was a little different. I had done Juliet at 14, so that I wasn't just doing movies. I was doing very special kinds of things. I mean, Anne Frank when I was 17, that's a little different than doing I mean, the hooker, I think Jodie Foster is wonderful, but there's different. There's a different image that goes with it. People have different expectations from you. And coming out of my background, I think there is a double standard. I think mm-hmm. that people were more demanding. I certainly was much harsher on myself, feeling that I had to. I mean, my God, you know, I was comparing myself to Marlon Brando, and, well, Jane Fonda hadn't started yet, but, you know, to people who were the top actors in America, saying, how can I? What if I fail? What will my father think? I don't want to embarrass him. And I remember going to my father at one point and saying, listen, Pop, I'm not going to study with you, because that way, if I'm terrible, they won't blame you. And if I'm wonderful, I'd like a little of the credit for myself. And that, you know, so that I don't know if it was too much too soon. I guess some of that was involved, too, to a degree.
Was being in the theater a prerequisite mm-hmm. for a close relationship with your parents?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so. And I don't think it was inevitable, either. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Inevitable, what that means. It happened, so it must have been inevitable at that time, but it not inevitable in the sense that my brother went off in a different direction. He's now in the theater. Not only did he go off in a different direction, but he's just becoming successful now. There was no instant kind of success. I'm trying to think, Gadge Kazan's, Elia Kazan's children, none of them went into the theater. I think one is a writer, is the closest. So that when people say, oh, well, you had to, I don't see that with the people that I know. The fondest, really, of the people that I grew up with did both go in, but they were both also very talented.
Yeah, you know, you grew up with so many people who are in public larger than life. But I guess to you, you knew them as maybe larger people, but also friends. What of the people who are mm-hmm. really celebrities that you knew, mm-hmm. Who struck you as having a very different public image from what their real self was?
Well, maybe I wasn't struck with so much. Well, Marilyn Monroe certainly was very different than that public image.
You told a wonderful story about Marilyn Monroe on the street.
Oh, yes. Well, she had this, you know, it's interesting when actors complain about not being able to go unnoticed. I remember Presley said he couldn't go out without being attacked, but he always went out as Elvis Presley. If he'd gone out dressed in a three-piece suit with a hat over his head and maybe a pair of glasses, maybe he wouldn't have been. It's so funny. We have that dichotomy of we want to have privacy, and yet if no one recognizes, we say, oh, no one loves me. Marilyn and I were walking down the street with a friend, and she used to, by the way, walk the streets of New York. In those days, you could walk the streets of New York or of anywhere. And she had on a scarf and dark glasses and a raincoat, I think no makeup. And nobody was paying any attention to her. And if anyone looked, it was kind of like a double take of, no, that couldn't be her because she wouldn't be walking down the street looking like that. And she turned to me out of the blue and said, do you want to see me be her? I didn't know what she meant, her, who. So I said, sure. And she did something. She made some inner adjustment, and suddenly she was mobbed by crowds. Now, it's interesting, when they did that movie on television about her, you know how the girl, it wasn't the girl's fault, she couldn't play it any other way, probably, although she's talented, I'm sure. The director had the girl whip off the scarf, shake her hair out, start wiggling her behind. In other words, and you know, moving in this parody of what sex was, and that was what attracted her, they missed the whole point of what Marilyn had. She didn't have to do that. She did nothing. She did some inner thing, and she was Marilyn. It was the innocence. It was that shimmery quality she had. I think, what is it Truman Capote said? What, that? Not wondrous child, a luminous child, something like that. It had nothing to do with the conventional idea. And when I saw it, I thought, boy, they've done a whole movie and they have no understanding of her. It was funny. I remember another time we were in a taxi together. We were going to my dad's acting class, and the driver was watching us in the rearview mirror, and he said, you girls actresses? And I said, yes. And when we got out, he turned to Marilyn. He said, you know, honey, he says, you're a lot prettier than Jane Mansfield. He says, you stick with it. I bet you could be a big star. She said,
up.
Oh, thank you, I will. And then when she called the guy from class, she called a boy from class to do a scene, and she said, hi. She said, this is Marilyn. I'd like to do a scene with you. And he, teasing her, said, Marilyn who? And she said, you know, Marilyn from class. Marilyn, I always think of that Marilyn from class. When the thing is that Marilyn had, it must have been very difficult for her, because I know how hard it is when people expect a certain thing and you're making money on it and you are successful to say to them, I'm more than this, I'm different than this. You're afraid you risk losing them that way. So for her to come east, to make that effort, really was a was an act of great courage. Listen, I think getting up some mornings is an act of great courage. You hear the news and want to go back to bed. She, when my father, during the eulogy, I had, it's funny because I always thought of Marilyn as being older, and at 17, what, I think she was 27. That was older. Now we would be contemporaries. It's so strange how those, just the difference of the years passing bring you closer. So that I always saw, I didn't identify with her really in any way. I liked her, but I didn't see myself. It's funny, we're the same sign. We're both Geminis, which means we have that. She had those two sides. She could be, it's like Anne Frank was another Gemini, and it's that ability to be, it's the Goethe thing, quote, I'm either in the depths of the depths of despair or the heights of elation. And Marilyn had that, or the ability which people don't understand sometimes. My friends sometimes don't understand how I can be crying one minute and the next making jokes and laughing, and I consider it a blessing because at least if you go down, you don't stay down that long. But when my father in the eulogy said, well, here was, what is it, this woman longing for life, reaching out with both hands, yet terrified. And I remember for the first time thinking, she's just like me. It's funny, we never talked about that. You know, the other story is the ironies of life, that when we were on Fire Island sharing a room together one summer, and I woke up and caught her, she was standing nude at the window watching the ocean, and I was watching her very enviously, I guess. At 17, I had just gotten Anne Frank. I was just about to open an Anne Frank, and 17, do you ever want to be who you are or what you are? You always think somebody else has it better. You should walk in their shoes first. So I wanted to be tall and sexy and blonde or whatever it is I thought that she had. And I said to her, oh, Marilyn, I'd give anything to be like you. And she turned to me and said, oh, Susie, don't say that. I'd give anything to be like you. And we just sat there and looked at each other. It was so, and she wanted to be respected. I was doing Anne Frank. That meant, the only thing she was ever on time for, I think, was the opening night of Anne Frank. I was very, well, at the time, I didn't realize what a big compliment that was. Isn't it funny? You don't appreciate it. Shaw was right. Youth is wasted on the young. I want it back. No, I don't. It's much better now than it was then.
Did you spend much time at the Actors Studio? Was that a big part of your training?
Well, not really, because I hadn't trained at all, but when I was doing Juliet in the early days of television and Picnic and Anne Frank, I had not studied. I guess I picked it up by osmosis, being around, and whatever, instinct, intuition. When I finally did, I became a studio member, I forget when, a little bit later. I went to some of my father's private classes, and I really found it too difficult. My father bent over backwards to be objective. And what it was, listen, most people, okay, can say, the audience hated me, the critics hated me. But my mother and father, they loved me. They love me no matter what I do. I couldn't say that. It was the reverse with me. I didn't care what the critics said. I was much more terrifying what my father was going to say or my mother. So I just could not take it objectively. I took everything personally. And, I mean, my father would, I remember once going to read a part for him that I wanted some, my mother said, go ask him. And I went and I cried through the entire thing because I was so nervous. And he said, is that the way you're going to play it? I said, no, I don't think so. I was just really, it was too hard. I couldn't balance Daddy with the teacher, and I guess I made a choice to have Daddy, not the teacher.
Yeah, I can...
You know what it was like, the doctor? I was the doctor's child. They don't let doctors operate on their own children. Yeah. My father was the doctor, and I was the patient, only I didn't have any anesthetic. I was wide awake, and it hurt.
Yeah, and I can see that conflict, because after all, who he's working with and...
That's right.
Sure. Did you get much resentment when you would get roles of people assuming that you got the role because of your
there are always going to be people who say, well, she got that because she's so-and-so's daughter. But and I guess that bothered me at the time. It doesn't now, because what I feel is there are advantages. You get into certain doors easier. However, once you get in, you have to deliver more than the kid from Iowa, let's say, because they're expecting a lot more from you. And I think other people sometimes can get away with something that I can't get away with.
When did you start resolving all of this?
Oh, about yesterday.
Really?
No. It's been a kind of gradual process. I think it, even in the kind of tumultuous or tempestuous crisis years of my life, I don't think that I wanted the pain. I guess I was trying to go through that fire to start resolving my identity crisis, my spiritual problems, my moral crises, whatever. I guess really when my daughter was born was the turning point for me in my life, because I realized that if I wasn't responsible for myself, I couldn't take care of this helpless human being who I loved more than anything in the world. And because she was born very ill with, she had four holes in her heart and a partial cleft palate, it forced me to deal with the now. You know, it's a thing of, we spend so much of our life guilty and nostalgic about the past or anticipating the future, which we have no control over. I'm not talking about setting goals now. I'm talking about anticipating the future. We forget to live today. And as far as we know, today is it. I can walk out of here and get hit by a car. So, you know, it's what my daughter being that sick, I think, taught me was the guilt is just a denier of life. It serves no purpose except to make you feel more rotten. I think it's the national disease, guilt and anxiety. Well, somebody else can have mine if they want it because I don't want it anymore. I gave already. I gave at the office. Listen, I still have it at moments anyway. It's hard. However, I really don't know. Then my whole perspective on life started to change. It was as if, you know, it's the old thing, is the bottle half empty or half full. I started getting up in the morning and just being happy that my daughter was breathing and alive and that the coffee smelled good and the flowers were blooming. And there's a story. I don't know.
Well, you know, I'd like to get back to talking about your daughter Jenny in a bit. But I must say that when I read your book, that you were in the parts that you talked about the actor's studio, you talked about some of the bad method acting that would come about because of people seeing a Brando or a Jimmy Dean and like getting into that superficially.
I tried to talk about the misconceptions, the misinterpretations of it. Which God knows there are.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things that you pointed out was the distinction that your father made between naturalism and realism. Could you talk about that? Because that really sort of enlightened me as to, well, what sort of is corny and what is...
As he said, you know, that to be real does not mean to be natural, naturalistic. You see, someone's that art is more beautiful than life, that when Jimmy Dean, for instance, leaned in on the car in... Giant, and what he pulled his hat down over it. It wasn't just a casual gesture. It was a casual gesture for a person that you saw going through a whole inner turmoil. And that character used that casual gesture to mask his inner feelings so Rock Hudson or whoever it was wouldn't see what he was really feeling. Well, what happened is that young actors picked up the outer thing, the shell of it, and didn't fill it with anything, and then it just became natural. I don't want to be natural. I want to see people be natural, go stand on a corner. I want to see them be real. And real sometimes is, acting is heightened reality. I don't mean that it has to be bigger, but it does have to be heightened. I mean, it's more selective. It is, after all, in its ideal, art. An art, like, you know, like a poem is the core of something, the moment of revelation.
You know, it would be useful if you could just, and I know you're not the origin of this, but you certainly, I'm sure, could briefly tell a little bit about what the method is, what is that concept?
Well, first of all, it's a way of work that Stanislavski, see, there was no craft for the actor. It was hit or miss. You had some of the great English actors, and they died, and then it was left. And what you had left was books that said, smile when you're happy, frown and make three wrinkles, and turn to the left when you're sad. I mean, literally, those were the acting standards. Even after we had Keane and Garrick and some of the great actors, it wasn't passed on. Not only was there the tradition lost, but the techniques, the things that they had gone through, so that it wasn't like dancing or music, where there was some kind of finger exercises or craft that everyone would do. So only an actor would dare get up not knowing anything. Which is, by the way, why I think a lot of actors feel a little embarrassed about their profession, as if it isn't quite the thing to do, you know. Stanislavski in Russia said, wait a minute, what have all the great actors of the past found out? They must have found something. And he correlated all this information, reading diaries, reviews, letters. And from that, he developed a series of exercises to stimulate. After all, acting is reacting to imaginary conditions to imaginary stimuli in a real way. Good luck, okay? Children do it all the time, but as we get older, the muscles get a little tighter, the inhibitions set in, it's not so easy. And even when you can do it once, can you do it 20 times or 50 for the camera or every night at 8 o'clock on cue? Okay. There's a story that illustrates it better, I think, than than even the explanations. When people say, well, how much do you believe? Well, obviously, if I believed, I would be crazy. And when I played Juliet and took the poison, I would have died. I really hate when actors, and I know sometimes they need it, they'll say, hit me. I worked with a wonderful French actress, Emmanuelle Arriva, who had done Hiroshima Mon Amour. I remember she said, you have to really hit me. I said, I can't. That's against my whole training. We're actors. We're supposed to. And I'm afraid I'll hurt you. She didn't hit me, and I wouldn't do it. And they put my costume on someone else who hit her, and she got a black eye and couldn't shoot for a month. I thought, that serves, you know, I'm glad it was someone else, not me. And that's, again, because there isn't the training. The story about how much belief you have when you are, let's say, a method actor or a good actor is Texas oil man dies and goes to heaven. And gets to the gates, and St. Peter says, oh, yes, I have your name down on the list, but I'm sorry, there's no room for you. And the guy says, what do you mean there's no room? Didn't I live a good life? I was nice to my wife. I gave to charity. Oilmen have a terrible reputation, so I really went out of my way to lead a very saintly life. And St. Peter says, you led a terrific life. Our quota for oilmen is filled. There's no room. And the oilman says, well, what am I supposed to do? Where am I supposed to go? And St. Peter says, well, I'm afraid there's only one place to go. I mean, it's hell. And the oilman says, that's not fair. Go to hell? So he thinks about it for a minute. He says to St. Peter, I'll tell you what. He said, if you let me into heaven for 5 minutes, if I can't make a place for myself, I'll go to hell, and I won't complain. St. Peter is so intrigued that he lets him in just to see what he'll do. And he notices this little oil man makes a beeline where all the other oil men are congregated. And he's whispering to all these different groups, and St. Peter can't hear what they're saying. Suddenly, there is a riot. I mean, the crowd screaming, running, pandemonium, and they're racing. They knock St. Peter down, they break open the gates of heaven, and they're running like crazy, and right at the back of them, running just as fast, is that first little oil man. And St. Peter just manages to get up and grab him. He says, wait a minute, wait a minute. He says, where are they going? The oil man says, they're going to hell. He says, what did you tell them? He said, I told them they struck oil in hell. He says, well, why are you going? He says, maybe it's true. And that's really what acting is. It's that childlike sense of wonder. A child knows it's playing, and when you say bang, bang, you don't die, but it's willing to maybe just give it somewhere. I know it's not true, but I'm giving it the benefit of the doubt. In my imagination, it's true. I can be Juliet. I can be Cleopatra. I can be Anne Frank. I can live in this person's skin for 2 hours.
Well, I'm talking with Susan Strasberg, who has just published her memoirs, and her memoirs deal with many things. Her childhood as the child of Lee and Paula Strasberg, and her own career as an actress, and some of the people that have peopled her life, including her daughter Jenny. I'd like to ask you about something. This is pretty obscure in your career,
right.
But
go ahead. A little obscurity at the end of the day doesn't hurt.
Tell us what you can about this. What recollections do you have of your first modeling job? You didn't even know who you did it for. It was either True Confessions or True Romance.
Not much. It's so obscure that I barely remember.
Were you like sort of in a scene that was?
Yes, it was. You know how they used to have on those covers where you would be in the middle of a scene and they'd say freeze and they say now hold her arm, she's struggling. Now scream, open your mouth, Susan. That's right. But a little light in the eyes. This is the 50s, remember?
What did your parents think of that? Was that like a nice first step for you? Or?
Oh, I don't think they were thrilled by it, but they figured it wouldn't hurt. It was better than, I think they didn't want me to go fully into acting. So that it, I wonder, was that my, I guess I did want to model at that time. I forgot that. That's right. So that although I didn't want to act really, I did want to do some, I guess I wanted to make some money for myself. I always had a very, it's funny, for someone who was so dependent for many years emotionally, I really made an effort to become independent financially. Interesting that the two had nothing, you know, one has nothing to do with the other. People always think, well, you've made it professionally. You must have made it as a woman or psychologically. And unfortunately, we're living in a schizophrenic society where, mind and body and soul are not always indelibly linked together, although I think that's changing with kind of holistic approach to medicine, things like that. I hope it is.
Well, I guess it wasn't too many years after you had modeled for whatever it was, True Confessions or True Love, that you had your first really big role as Anne Frank in The Diary of Anne Frank. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering how you prepared for that role and how you developed your sense of who Anne Frank was.
Well, first of all, on reading, well, I had read the book before I got the part. And I had such an, you know, it happens, and it's happened to me since then, too. When I read certain scripts, I almost, it's not even a question of working on them, I just, so empathize and identify with the character. Of course, those are the easy ones. Those are the easy ones. Then it's repeating it every night that becomes difficult. And with Anne Frank, first of all, I was an adolescent. She was an adolescent. Second of all, it's interesting, we were the same birth sign. She was only 10 years older than me. Isn't that amazing?
Really?
When I played that part, it seemed as if World War II was a million miles away. And recently I did something where we were celebrating her 52nd birthday, and I said, my God, I'm 42. She's, I mean, we could have been friends. Isn't that funny?
This is at Marilyn Monroe's age, I guess. Right.
And that even her whole attitude towards herself, her feelings about herself, you know, that thing she had about the duality of her character. She said, I'm so bad or so good. I don't understand this, the paradox of my nature. Well, that I identified with totally. So that I studied the period and the time and read and things like that. And also the things, the difference in, let's say, the behavior in a European family of that time than, let's say, the 1950s. You know, it shifts and changes so much. The character itself, though, because the book spoke even more than the play, her whole soul was in that book. You didn't have to go any further, you know, and I felt, there were nights before I went on stage when I felt that she was around me.
Well, was there any resonance with whatever sense of Jewishness you might have had when you did the role?
I guess that entered into it, too, except that it went so far beyond being a Jew, a Catholic. She was a universal soul. I mean, she happened to be Jewish. However, when you have, I think, a human being or a soul that's that aware or enlightened, they go beyond their sex, their religion, their things like that. And, of course, that made it hard, too, because people forgot that she was a brat and she was an adolescent and she had sexual feelings. They had a tendency to idealize her, romanticize her, and then they started to do that to me when I played the part. They would call me Anne Strasberg.
Well, you made some reference to changes from the diary that eventually were changed for the stage production.
Yes, her father at the time, which we didn't know, had cut out apparently some passages about her own sexuality, about herself as a woman, that he was embarrassed by.
That he had edited before.
In the 50s that he took out, yeah. And that now they're bringing out the unedited version. I'm very curious to see it.
Mm-hmm. What type of guidance did your parents give you in doing the role? Did they have much to say?
Well, yes, my father talked to me particularly about, what it must have been like to be trapped and shut up that way, particularly a person who was that alive. And, he's wonderful that he gives very full images that really set your imagination off. He has that capacity to say two words that are more than someone else's 50 words sometimes. I remember he once said to me about another part. I was playing Kitty in Saroyan's Time of Your Life, and he said, this is the kind of girl who, if you step on her toe, her foot, she says, excuse me. Really, I caught the whole character for me. Yeah. Well, maybe you have to be an actor to appreciate that.
Did you have to resustain yourself? And how long did you do Anne Frank?
A year and a half. I think it ran 2 years. It was too much for me. I couldn't. I really, without the technique, that's a killer. That is just, you notice that someone like Ellen Burstyn now will only go on Broadway for 6 months. I think it's unnatural. In the old days, you didn't have that. You had repertory so that you didn't, even if a play was a hit, you ran it in repertory. There's something about doing that every day in, day out. It goes against the nature of my character, I guess. I could do it. I could do it maybe 9 months, same time you take to have a baby. Same time I wrote the book in, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I guess this book's my second baby, except this one can't talk back.
Well, after you did Anne Frank, you went to Europe, and you were in a film called Capo?
Yes, that was much later, actually, because in between I did Time Remembered.
That's right. Yeah.
I did Stage Struck with Henry Fonda. I sometimes think that my career, I'm not that old, however, that in the 20, it's been almost, it's over a quarter of a century, but 27, 28 years, I think. 28 years, is that possible? 1954 to today is what?
That's 26.
No, it's more, 54, 74, 84, 80. Are you sure? That's more than,
well, I was born
86.
In 1954, so I shouldn't know.
Oh, okay. I take your word.
No,
but then I must have started earlier because I've been working, I figured out, I think, 27, 28 years. Anyway.
It's 27.
Okay,
it's 27
I knew.
Years.
See,
right.
So you can Thank make you. Yourself a year younger.
Okay.
So I'll never tell. That I realized that how, just in a kind of strange way, that my career had spanned the whole shift of consciousness in America in films. My first love scene, which was in Stage Struck with Henry Fonda, where where I played the young girl who was in love with this older man, this producer who Henry Fonda played. I remember they stood me on an apple box. I wasn't tall enough, even with my 4-inch high heels, for him to kiss me. And we were supposed to be madly, passionately in love. And it was this chaste, maybe 3-second kiss, maybe. I mean, lips closed, you know, I don't even think we embraced. We didn't all, it was just this, that was it. That was passion.
Touched palms, maybe.
Yes, and then 20-some-odd years later, I came to do my first more serious love scene in a movie with Peter Fonda, Henry's son, in a movie called The Trip. And this was at the time the first nude love scene, quote, nude love scene. I say that because I was wearing a bikini bottom. And you, in movies, you put something over your breast so that if they see you, the camera has to stop. It's like cotton, something like that. So I get this message as I'm preparing to do this scene from some friend of Peter Fonda saying, Peter wants you to know that he really feels that the only way he can play this scene is nude. And I said, that's okay. He can play it nude. I'm using the method. I'm acting nude. I'm not going to be naked, but it's okay. I can handle it. So I go onto the set, and I start to climb into bed with him, and he says, Susan, I said, I know, you're nude, and it's okay. He said, no, that's not it. He said, I just want you to know if I get excited, it's nothing personal.
Yeah, I guess you can take that two ways.
People think it's so romantic when you do those things. You don't know when you're thinking, oh, my God.
I really wanted to ask you about some of the films that you did with Corman, because I guess you also did Psych Out, which was a Roger Corman.
That wasn't Corman, I think. That was Dick Clark Productions. That was AIP, but it wasn't
Corman. Okay, because Corman later took the credit for it, but maybe not.
Wait a minute. Did he do? Was he in bad? I remember Dick Clark
My source is Leonard Maltin's Guide to TV Movies. On that, the important thing about that is, leading up to the big question, is that you were playing a deaf runaway.
Yes, an underage deaf runaway in Haight-Ashbury. Sounds awful. Actually, it wasn't bad though. It was. A lot of people got their start in that film, if you think Dick Rush.
Oh, yeah. Jack Nicholson,
Nicholson was his first big part. It was one of Bruce Dern's first big parts.
Right,
was the cameraman, was it Vilmos?
Zygmunt.
Ziggy, that's right. Richard Rush, who did the stuntman.
Yeah.
It was really.
Well, you know, when you think about all those Corman films, or those that call them the B-film school, I've always wondered whether the people working on them had a sense of parody when they were doing, like in the 1960s, motorcycle films or psychedelic films, that type of thing, if there was a sense of parody, or if there was really maybe, well, it was the 60s and this was just a movie expression of what was going on at the time.
I think Easy Rider was probably took itself more seriously than that. And this, I mean, we shot this in 3 weeks. You don't have time. And I can remember saying the scene where Bruce Dern is burning himself alive because he thinks he's Christ in the house. And I'm going, oh, my God, and I got to cry at this. And I'm trying. I'm just thinking, oh, well, you act. Listen, you practice your craft. So I don't think I've ever made fun. I don't think we made fun of the material, strangely enough. No, it was just part of what the times and what was going on. And in a way, even if I'd meant to make fun of it, I remember walking down the street in Haight-Ashbury and the camera was hidden. And I was dressed as this kind of poor girl from somewhere in the Middle West. And I remember people stopping me on the street, pimps and pushers, and trying to sell me. Oh, yes. And I was up on a roof with a kid who appeared on the roof. They were shooting. He didn't know it. And he was, I think, on LSD or something like that. And he was going to jump. It scared the hell out of me. In other words, so even if we had taken it lightly, the reality of it was brought home to us. Actually, that film, for its budget and its time, who was the woman in the New York Times gave it a review and said she couldn't tell if it was good because it was so much better than she expected, or if it was bad, and you see.
Hey, it's a great film.
I know. It's a classic. You know that they show that film in England? They line up around the
block. Oh, it's on TV like twice a week.
Andrew Jaglin said to me, my God, we're in a classic. I said, oh, another one.
Do you see them much on television, films of that era that you were in?
Not really. Yeah. I don't have the time, and also am I going to become the queen of late-night television? I'm too young.
Well, we were talking earlier about how the tone of a relationship will change when you get older or when you spend time with somebody. I was wondering, your father's really, a very special person.
Yes, he's extraordinary.
And very sort of interesting relationship between you two because of your acting career and who he is and so forth. I was wondering how becoming an adult when you became an adult, when you became a mother, whatever interior changes happened, how that affected the relationship with your father and I guess with your mother when she was still alive.
Well, first of all, there's an old saying, never judge your parents until you've had children of your own. My mother and I, unfortunately, the relationship was left in a way unresolved because she died when I was still coming out of the bad marriage and my daughter had just been born with these four holes in her heart. And so that many of these things, although I think my mother, I feel my mother's around me, protecting me. I know she's there, and sometimes I say, well, I'm sorry, Mom. I know sometimes my daughter will talk to me in a way, and I say, my God, did I talk to my mother that way? I couldn't have been. That's awful. And I say, if I did, Mother, forgive me. It's not too late. And I believe that a love relationship doesn't end. You go on resolving it even when the person is gone. I'd rather do it when they're there. When you're younger, you don't realize how precious time is. However, when you're young, you're caught up in your own pain, your own story. You never stop to think, well, I'm trying to think, my father was rather distant when I was a child. Well, I didn't know why, so I took it all very personally. He's distant because I'm not a good girl, because he doesn't love me, because there's something wrong. Never thinking, well, my father worked 14, 15 hours a day teaching, talking, came home, was probably exhausted. Also, I didn't know that I idealized him, so I never thought of him as being human. If you think that someone had told my father when I was about 3 years old that it had sexual connotations if you touched a little girl too much after a certain age. And my father stopped touching me. You know, the best way to describe, I guess, my father's personality was he was very giving on a certain level and very shy in another level. You know, we used to go to Fire Island every summer. My father loved the ocean, and every day he would walk down to where the waves were breaking, and he would walk in up to his ankles, never pass, never go swimming, never go in. And Anne Bancroft had the house next door, and she came up to him one day on the beach. She said, Lee, I have to ask you a personal question. She said, I have watched you now for 3 years. You walk down to the ocean, you love it, and you never go in past your ankles. Why don't you go in? And he looked at her and he said, darling, I don't want to get involved. So in a way, you know, that's kind of touching, but I didn't know that. And I think, you know, when you're young, you always think it's you, your fault. There's that kind of selfishness of youth. I keep saying to my daughter, Jenny, believe me, nobody's looking to see if your slip is showing, because they're so worried about, is their hair combed? How are you thinking of them? And as I get older, I learned to take things less personally also. And I began to stop reacting to things and dealing with them. By that, I can give an example. My father has changed also tremendously also. He has grown, and maybe that's, I think he's a genius, and I think he's an extraordinary human being. And he has any man who has the courage at 76 to go and become an actor, I taught him everything he knows, is pretty terrific, because a lot of the other acting teachers had tried to act and not been successful. So it was a true risk. And what's life if you don't take risks?
One of the really wonderful acting things that, well, the only thing, I guess I've maybe I've seen him act it in maybe two things, but the one that really stands out is his role in Going in Style, which was a movie with, I guess, Art Carney and George Burns, older men, senior citizens living on Social Security.
Oh, but Godfather 2 was extraordinary, too, though. That was an extraordinary performance.
Yeah, no, that's...
Both
of those films, this question applies just in sort of the way that he's confronting aging and how he's growing with that.
My father has mellowed considerably, which I think is probably natural. I hope I've mellowed considerably, or that the experience that I've gone through have made me a nicer woman, a different kind of person, whatever. He, I guess, you know, what happens is as we get older, I think it's Socrates. Yeah, Socrates, I think, said, or it's Plato, the unexamined life is the only tragedy. And when some people, when they get older, do begin to examine, and I think that my father has. And what I have realized now is you can't change anyone else and ask them to love you the way you want to be loved. What you have to see is with my father making pancakes for me in the morning is his way of saying I love you. And if I say it with a hug and a kiss, it doesn't make it better or less. So we communicate now. It's funny because I had a thing with my father where we were supposed to go out to dinner. And I had canceled some appointments to go. And this is a number of years back, he said, oh, he was tired. He didn't want to go. And I said, oh, that's fine. I went in the other room. I started to cry. And I said, wait a minute, why am I crying? Like a 3-year-old little girl has been rejected by daddy. I said, I can't change him, but I can at least begin to, again, it's the thing I'm saying, not react, deal with this. And I went back and I said, listen, I just want to tell you, I really am looking forward to it. I was very disappointed that you can't go. I had canceled some appointments, and let's make another date. He looked at me and said, you were disappointed? You were looking forward to it? He said, well, I'm not that tired. He said, let's do it tonight. He said, I didn't know that it meant anything to you. And I realized that what's so sad, most people's lives, is they never get to a point where they communicate. You know what we do? We say the things out loud, and the vulnerable part, we do in an inner monologue. We do in that stream of consciousness. And then we say, why isn't the other person reacting to what I've just said to myself? And you've forgotten to say it to them. And although you can't change someone else, when you react differently, you give them a choice of reacting. And that's been a great relief in my life. I must say it's getting better and better.
How did your father prepare for the Hyman Roth role?
Oh, I don't know, but I know that when he prepares for a part, he really, my stepmother says that he started like he bought her a sexy nightgown. And she said, what are you doing? And then he got like a little sharp with her. And she said, don't get sharp with me. She said, oh my God, you're living your part. That he slept, I think, in one of his shirts. I don't know if I have to find out if that's true, but that because he thought Roth was someone who would like wear rumpled shirts, and he
brought such a nice air of kindliness, but really
he decided, he said that the thing about those kind of people, the mafia, and that is not that they do it out of anger or rage, but out of business is business. I'm sorry, I have to kill you. That's the way it is. Either you do it or I don't. And that cold-blooded of this nice person, as someone said, of what was so funny is when my stepmother had some of her family go to Las Vegas, and she made a reservation, and they said, oh, is this the man's family? She said, the man? And they said, nothing's too good for the man. We saw him in that movie. I mean, they had confused him with the man's family. She said, oh, my God.
Well, I understand that you're at the end of one leg of the publicity tour.
Yeah,
that
I'm
going to
go do a movie in California.
Yeah, what's up for you?
Well, I'm doing something called Sweet 16. Not my life story, as you might think. I have a friend who called and said, gee, Susan, you look good for your age, but I think that's stretching it. I said, no, no, I play the mother. It's a kind of, what is it? It's not a horror film. It's because it sort of has other elements. It's more of a suspense film. I don't know. I haven't seen I don't watch the horror films. My daughter loves them and sees them. Oh, I don't know how she does it. I know it's make-believe. I just don't want to see it. I'll act in them, but I don't want to have to. I won't pay my money. That's
who's
my
directing it.
A man called Jim Soto. So I think this is his first film. It's an independent film, and I don't even know, which is awful, who's starring in it. Leslie Nielsen's playing my husband, and I know, so we're starring in that. There's a young girl in it who's, I can't remember her name now because it's someone who's never acted before, and I don't know who the male actor. Oh, listen, when I get to New York tonight, before I fly to California tomorrow morning and start work Monday, I will get all this information.
Yeah.
It's hectic. My mother used to say, listen, Susan, don't complain when it's too much. Complain when it's too little.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming and sharing lots of thoughts and memories of your background. And I've been speaking with Susan Strasberg, and just a few moments ago we were speaking about Susan's father, Lee Strasberg, who was the director of the Actors Studio, and as we were talking, also played Hyman Roth in The Godfather and was in Going in Style. And Susan has written her memoirs. It's called they're called Bittersweet, and it's available on New American Libraries. It's a paperback. Thanks again for being here today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, that's about it for today's Fresh Air. On Monday, Terry Gross will have she'll be off for a day, but she'll be back on Tuesday. Of course, every Monday at 3:30, we hear from Judy Stein, Fresh Air's Arts Review critic. And then at 4 o'clock, Alec Wilder and the American Popular Song. That'll be this Monday. Contributing to today's show has been Bill Van Wert. Stephen Waterman has produced has provided technical assistance, and Maeve McGorn is Fresh Air's associate producer. By the way, this Sunday at 7 o'clock, we'll be airing part 2 of a special program on the Shiva exhibit at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. It's called Visions of Shiva. It was produced by Larry Massett for National Public Radio. That will be this Sunday at 7 o'clock, part 2 of that. Well, for Terry Gross, my name is Danny Miller. I hope you have a great weekend. Thanks very much for listening. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, listener-supported public radio.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, this is Noah Adams.
I'm Linda Wertheimer with All Things Considered.
One thing that did come to Kansas in the 1870s were the grasshoppers. The skies would be filled with them. They would eat everything green. That was what they were really after. One woman talked about wearing a green and white striped dress. She was a little girl at the time, and she said the grasshoppers ate the green stripe off of her dress.
They were pioneers, and the life was hard and lonely, but often with their strength came fulfillment. The women who went to Kansas in the 1800s, tonight on All Things Considered.
And these stories, 160,000 coal miners could go back to work soon if they liked their new contract better than the last one they were offered.
A collapse of a compromise, now back to the beginning for President Reagan's tax cut plan.
Two reports tonight from the Middle East concerning yesterday's airstrikes into Lebanon by Israel. We'll hear from Jerusalem and Beirut.
The United Nations has been giving money to newspapers around the world to help publicize the needs of the Third World. There is some criticism of this method.
We'll check in with the Van Cliburn Piano Competition in Fort Worth.
And a final tribute to soprano Rosa Poncel.
But first, news of this hour from Richard Harris.
Lebanon reports another Israeli commando raid inside its borders today, the third reported attack on Palestinian positions since U.S. peace envoy Philip Habib left the Middle East 2 days ago. And PLO chief Yasser Arafat accused the U.S. of giving the Israeli military the green light. But at the White House today, praise for Habib in averting a Syrian-Israeli war over those missiles in Lebanon. President Reagan called Habib's mission almost miraculous.
When he went there, the guns were all cocked and ready to go.
Habib says he'll continue his Middle East diplomacy sometime next week and thinks peace is possible.
It's important that everyone behave in the area, all parties in the area behave with restraint. Restraint not only in terms of the actions that they take, but it's also restraint with respect to the dispositions of the forces in the area so that you don't increase the possibility of the thing getting out of hand.
Yesterday, Israeli jets attacked a missile base in Lebanon that Israel said was manned by Libyans. Today, the State Department acknowledged that Libyans are helping Palestinians in Lebanon. Here's NPR's William Drummond.
Till today, the State Department had been unable to say whether there were Libyan military people involved in the Lebanon situation. But at the department briefing, Deputy Spokesman David Passage gave a tentative figure of 150 Libyans. Passage was unable to give any more details, but he called the Libyan presence in Lebanon unhelpful. Later, Secretary of State Alexander Haig was in St. Louis, and he expanded on that by attacking Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi.
I don't have to tell you that we in the West are increasingly concerned about Mr. Gaddafi's lawless activity in a direct military sense and in his...